Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So I've been given the opportunity to maybe earn a little merit this evening by offering a break to the other senior monks from giving a Dhamma talk. And I was feeling a bit drowsy before evening puja, but I had a cup of that Sri Lankan black tea and I'm pretty wound up now, so not sure what will come out. I was during the sit this evening, probably because of the cup of black tea, I started thinking about one of the lines in one of our chants that we do, one of the reflections that we do on a fairly regular basis, and this visualization, this visual image came up in my mind of my being in a hospital bed towards the end of my life, maybe just like within the last half an hour, hour of life, oxygen mask on my face, and taking slow, deep breaths, barely able to catch my breath, knowing that it was coming towards the end. And I was surrounded by the members of the Sangha here, Ajahn Pasno on one side of the head and Ajahn Amaro on the other side, and the bhikkhus and novices and anagarikas kind of around the bed, you know, watching my last coming about. And the reflection that we sometimes chant came to mind, that has my practice borne fruit with freedom or insight, so that at the end of my life I need not feel ashamed when questioned by my spiritual companions. I had this image of people standing there with clipboards. Ajahn Pasno saying, "So, Karunadamo, are you ashamed? Any insights? Any freedom, moments of freedom?" My thinking, well, 3 years ago I didn't yell when somebody was angry at me. I didn't yell back. How's that? So I'm like, well, yeah, one merit point there. So anyway, it was this kind of, kind of an amusing image really, but I've always actually kind of not really liked that particular reflection. Still this sense of despair. I know it's meant to be a motivating contemplation, but sometimes it's hard to see it that way. So I think I was thinking that just because reflecting on, you know, we all have these ups and downs in our practice. As we go and go through the practice. Sometimes we have a lot of expectations about attainments and wanting to experience freedom and insight immediately, or even in what we think is a long period of time, but really in the perspective of practice, spiritual practice is a relatively short time. When we have access to such good readings and reading the suttas and hearing the the fruits of hearing about the fruits of practice and the levels of spiritual attainment. We can sometimes get this consumer mind of, that's what I want, that's what I need. I don't want to wait, show me the fast track. It's that kind of sense of entitlement to the best, the fastest. And for most of us, it doesn't seem to work that way. So sometimes after being, oftentimes people, when they enter monastic life or first start the practice, meditation practice or in the household life, can experience some really profound moments of insight. And then a common experience is for that to kind of peak and reach a kind of a plateau for periods of time, and sometimes you just wonder, oh gosh, what happened to that initial that initial momentum. Not all, but many people, go through periods like this throughout their practice, throughout their life. Some people, can get actually quite despairing about that. I've, heard of and known, monks who have, disrobed after 10 years, 20 years, even longer, because they just felt like they haven't been able to experience the fruits of practice in the way that they would have expected, would have liked. People in the household life, similarly, just, after many years of practice, finding a bit of disinterest growing, maybe giving up the meditation practice for periods of time, experiencing lulls in the practice. So it's a common experience. And to me, it's just a reminder of how important it is to recollect the gradual path, that this is a gradual path. I mean, just a couple of times recently, Ajahn Suddhanto has been very complimentary to me in saying that he thinks that I'm the epitome of the gradual path. And definitely, offered that as a supportive compliment, and I appreciated. I have to admit that sometimes it feels more like the gradual path of a slug. Very slow movement sometimes is what it feels like. But it's an important, I think it's an important concept and an important teaching. And one that bears a little review, because when we have these stale moments in practice, when just can't get rid of a particular obsession or dealing with a very unwieldy mind and it's all over the place, or some emotional state that seems like it has happened a zillion times before, and you don't think that there's ever going to be any freedom from that kind of habitual reaction to some circumstances, and you just think it's kind of hopeless. When those kind of mind states appear, those kind of experiences appear, there needs to be a way to deal with that, a place to turn to, a refuge to go to. Just to be able to weather those difficult periods. And to me, the recollection of the gradual training is a really important thing to do to help deal with those mind states. And in a nutshell, it begins with the recollection of of virtue. It's the beginning of this gradual path. And, you know, when these difficult times appear, we can just go straight back, go back to the basics, go back to our foundational practices of virtue, morality, sila, the precepts, like the people just took the eight precepts. But going back to even the first four of the five precepts, the first four being the ones most specifically associated with morality or virtue, just reflect on the power of that you know, if you followed to the best of your ability those first four precepts, the moral precepts of not taking life, not taking things that aren't given to you, refraining from taking advantage of people sexually or in any other way, restraint in speech, telling the truth to the best of your ability. That's a you know, a very reassuring place to put your reflective capacity, because, you know, at the very least, if you can recollect that attempt to follow those precepts, you can reassure yourself that you've done no harm. May not have accomplished all the things that you think you should in terms of spiritual practice, but you've done no harm. And that in itself is an incredible gift to the world. It's a gift that, you know, probably 95-99% of the people in the world can't call claim to. So we have these precepts which are very clear, which are very foundational, that provided just this sense of well-being when we reflect on them. So that's the place to start. I've done no harm. What a good thing. In the gradual path that the Buddha describes, what often follows is the practice of sense restraint. And sense restraint sometimes has this image or this connotation of being shut off from the world, or, you know, being in total isolation, or this big sensory deprivation tank where, you know, there's no impingement, no experience to disturb the mind. But that's not really what it's all about. Generally speaking, I mean, there are times and there are situations where avoidance of certain sensory stimulation is an important part of the practice, when we find ourselves getting really derailed with different mind states like lust or anger. Then, you know, sometimes we have to remove ourselves from situations just to not be involved with them at all. But generally speaking, what it means is not so much that as not attending to the signs and features of certain sensory experiences that lead to unskillful mind states. So it's not a total isolation from sensory experience, but more of a how to attend wisely to the sensory experiences that come into our life. So, you know, whether it's visual images that are evocative of sensual desire or evocative of anger or avoidance or irritation, we still take in those images, but we do it with wisdom, with clear comprehension. We see them as best we can. We consider them for what they are, in and of themselves, without being fooled by their illusory nature. We can see how if we improperly attend to something, that we get drawn into the illusion of attractiveness or desire or unpleasantness, avoiding, you know, wanting to avoid something just by the way that it appears in our mind. We don't see it in its true nature. So it's attending to things wisely that is part of this sensory restraint. Same with pleasant sounds, unpleasant sounds. You know, we might hear, while we're meditating, we might hear some disturbing noise, the dog in the distance barking, and feel aversive to that. You know, why is that dog interrupting my meditation? Or the people across the street playing their music loudly during our winter retreat period. You know, can move into intense irritation with that when it's in its third hour of country western music. But we don't have to pick that up. You know, we can be with that and hold it lightly and let it be just what it is without attending to the annoying quality of it. You know, what we think is the annoying quality. Just let it be what it is. Don't go out to it with irritation. Or pleasant sensations, tastes, smells, things that we would normally be attracted to or repulsed by. The meal offering today, you know, was full of opportunity to experience sensual desire. There was just such a incredibly prolific and generous offering made. And, one can appreciate the spirit of generosity and kindness and happiness that went into offering that, and still attend to things in a way that are conducive to a more equanimous state of mind, not necessarily leaping to the cookies and pumpkin pie and all the things that are screaming for attention over on that left-hand table. But, trying to, again, appreciate the spirit of generosity and care and kindness that they were offered with, and taking that which, you know, is going to be nourishing, and noticing, you know, the taste, but not moving into it, not allowing oneself to be consumed by the sensual delight of it all. So again, not shutting off the experience, but seeing it for what it is. Just in and of itself. So, sensory restraint is part of our gradual training too, and that's something that, you know, that we can do. It's sometimes it's a little bit challenging, but it's a part of the practice that most of us are quite capable of putting our attention on. And it's a very important reflection to just aid us in daily living as we develop the path. In fact, the reflection on food is such an important one that the Buddha separately lists that in his gradual path description. Just moderation in eating is a specific mention in that series, as is the reflection on moderation in sleep, not overindulging in sleep, because we can see how that's one that's easy to get trapped into too, particularly after we've maybe missed the mark a little bit on the food line. kind of taken a few too many delicious, rich things, then maybe we get up to our kuti and we've kind of done a bit of overindulgence in the sensory realm, in the realm of becoming. And now we want to kind of counteract that in the realm of non-becoming and do a little bit of annihilation for a couple of hours. the Buddha talks about the importance of moderation in sleep too, because that's, in a way, that's, you know, wasted time if we overindulge and if we use sleep more of as an escape than just as a moment of needing to refresh the mind. Because it is, I think, as Ajahn Chah once mentioned to Ajahn Amaro, sleep is delicious, isn't it? We can really enjoy those moments of just not having to be. Of course, the problem is that we wake up and are back to where we were before we crashed out. So that's a part of the gradual training as well. Once we've kind of established our virtue and geared our lives towards around a little bit more of simplicity and renunciation around the sensory world, try to moderate our more extreme habits, then that provides a firmer basis for us to just enjoy meditation. You know, if we have a relatively clean mind, free from regrets and remorse, free from overstimulation of the senses, alert, since we haven't engaged too much in overeating or oversleeping, then that creates a really nice basis for just being able to sit and enjoy some meditation practice. And kind of along the gradual path, that part of the meditation practice involves attending to the mind states that are appearing as we've established ourselves in some establishment of mindfulness. We're trying to watch our body or feelings or mind states. And as different hindrances come up, we need to take note of those and have a strategy for working with those. And I find that actually, you know, if my mind isn't immediately settling down in a meditation period, which is often the case, the reflection on the five hindrances is really a good way to spend a chunk of that meditation time. In fact, it's, you know, if you'll remember, it's part of the fourth establishment of mindfulness, the fourth satipatthana. In fact, it's that first section is contemplation of the five hindrances. So you're actually doing a mindfulness practice by contemplating the five hindrances. And I find it just very useful to, you know, when my mind isn't settling with the breath or whatever object you choose, sound of silence, breath, whatever, if the mind isn't settling with that, to just use some structure for recollection. You know, what's the hindrance that's present? Just go through the five hindrances. Is there any sensual desire? Is there any ill will? Is there any sloth, torpor, drowsiness, dullness of the mind? Is there restlessness or agitation, worry, anxiety? Is there doubt? So to go through them one by one and really take stock and notice what it is that's preventing your mind from settling down in the meditation? What's not allowing it to settle with the breath? Not in any kind of judgmental way or pejorative way, but just in a way that's curious, that's looking towards investigation. And oftentimes I think, you know, many people will find that they have a predominant hindrance that seems to be at the forefront. But oftentimes it might be mixed with one of the other ones as well, or two of the other ones, or maybe sometimes even all five at the same time. But to get a handle on that, and not so much, I find it's not so useful to do it in a real analytical way, with a lot of conceptual thinking, but more on a experiential level, on a feeling in the body level. You know, is there a sense of aversion present? Am I thinking about, you know, are the thoughts ones that are occurring, in, you know, in relation to, say, a negative interaction that I had with somebody a few days ago, or yesterday, or a few minutes ago? And if there seems to be these thoughts going around, well, that's a clue. There's ill will there. But to set aside the concept, set aside the thinking part of it, the words, and to really get a feeling for it in the body. Well, how do I know? How do I know this is aversion? Where can I feel that in my body? The hindrances in pretty much any emotional state are very noticeable in the body. And that's where I find that they're most easily attended to and dealt with. So that if I can actually feel that tension in the head or the neck or the stomach associated with aversion, and really just attend to it, not in a way of trying to get rid of it, which is just adding more aversion, but just in a way of knowing it, acknowledging it, bringing the breath to it, setting aside the concept, setting aside the justification for it, and just being with the feeling in the body, that in itself can very quickly allow it to pass away. Just knowing it will allow it to pass much more quickly than struggling with it or bargaining with it. I find the same is true for all the hindrances. If there's some sort of fantasy of pleasure going on in the sensual realm as a way of distracting, you know, what might be otherwise a boring time, you know, sometimes the mind will move towards something that's more stimulating or exciting in a pleasurable way. Well, once you realize that's happening, see, you know, just feel that feeling. What is it? There's often this kind of feeling of excitement or that can actually, when you really look at it, almost feels a bit like agitation. You know, there's sort of this pleasurable tilt to it because it's something that would normally bring at least a fleeting moment of enjoyment. But there's this quality of non-peacefulness, excitement, mild agitation that's associated with this kind of thought of sensual desire. And that in itself is really, you know, a hindrance to the peaceful mind. It's a disturbance. It's just not peaceful. Or, you know, common one I think for many is the experience of restlessness or anxiety. And that's a real good one to feel in the body. And to bring the breath to, you know, where is that sense of, how do I know that it's anxiety? I can feel this, you know, tension or gripping tightness in the stomach or the head, you know, accompanied by kind of rapid thoughts, rapid thinking going on. You know, what's that like? Just feel it. What's that like? And that's a great one to bring the breath to, because that's the actual antidote to that particular hindrance, is mindfulness of breathing. So bringing the breath right to that experience, that physical experience, is a very calming thing to do. Don't worry about the objects that are coming through in your thinking, the different things that you might provoke anxiety or fear or worry or concern. Those have been there for a long time, and those will come and go again. You don't have much control over that. But if we attend to the actual physical effect, bring our breath to it, then we have a sense of how it can arise and cease very quickly, and how it, we don't need to proliferate about it. Don't need to add anything more to it. Just let it live its life out. Be with it kindly and gently. Let it go. Dealing with the hindrance of dullness or sleepiness, sloth, torpor, sometimes that's a little bit more difficult, because the nature of that kind of mind state is very deluding, is very thick, and it's harder to get a perspective on. It's easier to just check out. But everybody, I'm sure, knows the traditional ways of dealing with it from the suttas. But I've also found that sometimes just the mental rousing of energy to the level of, can I just really experience this sleepiness? What does this feel like? What do my eyelids feel like? What does this fuzz in my brain feel like? What does it feel like to be swimming through cotton? And that investigative curiosity in itself can help rouse enough energy to help contravene that mind state. So being curious with these hindrances, and similarly with doubt, knowing what is this experience of doubt, this mind jumping around of unsure, confusion. So those are that's where we start, it's time well spent. Even if that's your whole meditation period, if you're using that consciously to really investigate and to understand these mind states, that's a very acceptable and very useful way to spend the meditation time when the mind isn't wanting to settle down on an object. Really just be very open and spacious and kind and inquisitive and willing to look at it from this framework of the hindrances. So if we've been able to be successful with these parts of the gradual path, then it provides the opportunity for the mind to settle down and just enjoy these aspects of the path. That we don't have to always be experiencing deep penetrative moments of insight to be what we would consider a successful practitioner. We have to realize that the path is a gradual one, and there's many, many aspects to it that we can and need to attend to all along the way. And take delight in it, actually, too. Really realize that every part of the path, from the beginning to the middle to the end, is a path that creates happiness in its own way. We don't have to be constantly dwelling in a impeccable state of emptiness to say, oh, okay, well, there are some moments of freedom and insight, even if it's just, I haven't harmed anybody today. That's something to take delight in. And if we can use that as our frame of reference, then we won't get so caught in this sense of non-achievement, this sense of despairing of how well have I spent my time, because we indeed have spent our time in some good ways, in ways that will continue to firm up our foundational practice. So, what about those transcendent states, though? I mean, do we just totally give up hope, or think that it's out of our reach in this lifetime, or do we, how can we sort of hold that so that we don't lose the fact that we are engaged in a practice that does lead to transcendence, that can lead to transcendence? We're not such hopeless. None of us are such hopeless cases that we should totally dismiss that as a possibility in this lifetime. But yet, we may not be quite there to, experience a deep penetrative experience of the transcendent. One of the teachings of the Buddha is that this gradual path is like the continental shelf off the coast of India, where it's a very gradual decline off the continental shelf, and then at some point there is a sudden drop off, or in the example of spiritual practice, the gradual path with the sudden, very gradual path practice, and then an experience of penetration, a sudden change in one's experience that points towards that transcendence. So how do we hold that in perspective in a way that's not daunting, and that we aren't judging ourselves for how far we are on that gradual path, but also gives us a sense of inspiration or a sense of what the potential is in this practice. And I really appreciated reading in The Island something that I hadn't come across before. It was in the section on practices and perspectives, and that's that actually maybe not necessarily experiencing the depth of penetration of the unconditioned, but bringing up the perception of Nibbana is a very fruitful practice, and in fact one that the Buddha says that even someone who practices just for a finger snap, the perception of Nibbana has earned his or her alms food for the day. That's a very important and useful perception to bring up in the mind. So I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, well, the perception of the peace of Nibbana. Well, that's not necessarily the actual experience. That's not the deep penetration, the stepping off of the continental shelf. But I can get a hint of that. We can all get a hint of that from the various descriptions, just by considering them and reflecting on them, and kind of a way to help condition the mind towards that perception is through first of all through contemplation of what it's not. Ajahn Siddhanta last night was kind of referring to some of that with his recollection of the practice of contemplation of the five khandhas, and the three characteristics in relation to them. You know, just really spending time with the contemplation of, say, the form or body, you know, as not being self, and as it says in the some of the suttas, the Anattalakkhana Sutta particularly, you know, really thinking about this body is not self. You know, if this body were self, it wouldn't lead to affliction, and I'd be able to say in regard to this body, let it be like this or let it not be like this. But since it is not self, it necessarily leads to affliction, unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, because it's not in our control. We can influence it, we can take care of it as best we can, but really, in the long run, in the end, it's not under our control. And therefore, it's going to be ultimately unsatisfactory. So that's not where I put my refuge. It will always change. And the same is true for the other khandhas, the feelings that come up in our mind, pleasant or unpleasant. They will also be out of our control. They are going to eventually lead to dissatisfaction. Perceptions themselves, thoughts, mental formations, any kind of moods, all will be unsatisfactory, impermanent, not self, consciousness itself. So reflecting on that, using that as a basis for active reflection, we can come to this sense of, okay, well, you know, not in a negative way, but this isn't where I can take my refuge. This is the conditioned realm. This isn't the be-all and the end-all. And then we can recollect the teachings on the peace of Nibbana, and we realize that aside from this conditioned realm, there is the unconditioned. We may not know it directly, but we have a sense of faith. We have a sense that this is a way of knowing that we can experience. Even if we don't do it directly, we know that once we're able to drop this clinging to, this attachment to these conditioned experiences of the khandhas, that there is this peace that is beyond any kind of peace that we can know in the conditioned realm, even in the highest states of meditation, in the highest meditative attainments. There's a peace that's even more sublime and is a result of letting go. It's a result of turning gently away from all of these aspects of the conditioned realm. It's a piece of clear seeing, a piece of non-attachment, of gently turning away from all of these other things that have fooled us for so long. A sense of deep, deep release. So we can imagine that. We can bring that perception to mind. We can spend time with that. That sense of letting go, of non-arising, cessation. And just enjoy that. Even if it's a conditioned perception in itself, we can establish that in our mind as a possibility, knowing that the path will eventually lead to that penetration of that experience. And just rest in that. And the Buddha says that establishing that perception is time well spent. Even if just for a finger snap, it's time well spent. More so, the more one is able to spend with that kind of perception. So when we're experiencing these periods of not being so inspired or not being so inspirational, that we can recollect, we can remember that this is a gradual path. We can, work on the foundational aspects. We can work on mindfulness in our daily life. We can work on the hindrances in our meditation. And we can establish a perception of the peace of Nibbana and be with that, be with those practices. These are all things that we're all capable of doing. And then we just let things happen as they will without forcing. We just keep on practicing these different things over and over again. Just because in and of themselves they're a joyful thing to do. They're something that will lead us along the way. And we let the results and the fruits happen as they will. Not have to worry about them, not have to be concerned about, whether we're going fast enough, far enough. Leaving that self-judgment out of the picture. And just taking heart in the path itself, in the practice itself, with a real sense of contentment and gratitude for the fact that the Buddha was so brilliant to be able to present that to us in a way that anybody can benefit from it. So I think that's plenty for this evening.